Hello, and welcome to Holden Village. Today is June 28th, 2005. Today's session is entitled Daily Work and Daily Bread, presented by Lynn Rhodes. Disc number RHL-2005-02.
Quotes and things that I found particularly helpful in my own life that I like to look at. And I'd like to start with a poem by Marge Piercy, To Be of Use. Do any of you know that poem? As sort of her opening meditation. I love it. No one but, you're the only one that knows that poem, I guess you're.
Well, but soon we all will.
Soon we all will. And I've made a copy for people who would like to listen to it. This is by Marge Piercy, and it's our opening meditation. The people I love the best jump into work head first without dallying in the shallows and swim off with sure strokes almost out of sight. They seem to become natives of that element, the black sleek heads of seals bouncing like half-submerged balls. I love people who harness themselves an ox to a heavy cart, who pull like water buffalo with massive patience, who strain in the mud and the muck to move things forward, who do what has to be done again and again. I want to be with people who submerge in the task, who go into the fields to harvest and work in a row and pass the bags along, who stand in the line and haul in their places, who are not parlor generals and field deserters, but move in a common rhythm when the food must come in or the fire be put out. The work of the world is common as mud. Botched, it smears the hands, crumbles to dust. But the thing worth doing well done has a shape that satisfies, clean and evident. Greek amphoras for wine or oil, Hopi vases that held corn, are put into museums, but you know they were made to be used. The pitcher cries for water to carry, and a person for work that is real. Amen. I also love this little one. For those of us who are getting older, the joy of living is in work. I have a great curiosity, a deep need to excel. I feel more creative than ever. I feel like all my force is coming together. I'm just getting going. Gordon Parks, photographer, 85 years old. Yes! And I put some of these favorite quotes together over there for you. Today I'd like to talk about daily work and daily bread. In Jesus' prayer, one of the lines, lines I think we kind of skip over, it says, give us this day our daily bread. And one of the things I've learned from the New Testament scholar I work with is that mostly he was talking about reality. He was not talking about metaphor. And that give us our daily bread means our daily bread, not some spiritual something or other. It means the food we need to survive. And I think that this earthiness, this attention to our real bodies and our real needs for bread have sometimes gotten lost in our understanding of daily work. And that I want to suggest that providing daily bread is our central work issue. That much of the work of providing daily bread is not paid labor, or is poorly paid, or is a routine work to be done, and is not given much significant meaning. That often when we talk about, you know, the glory of God and justice and spiritual fullness, and somehow the daily work of providing daily bread gets diminished. And I say this from my work with congregants, that their daily work, they do not see it as significant and as or get that feeling of what it means to provide daily bread. And I want to talk about some of the reasons that happens in our culture, but I also want to give you just, for me, an experience that brought that to such reality. In 1980, I went to Cuba, and whatever we want to say about the government or the repressive regime, I was overcome by my experience of talking to workers in Cuba at that time in 1980, when they were still really trying to create a new society. And I went to a farm where a man was milking cows. That was his job. He was producing milk. And over the cows was this graft. And on the graft, it showed each day how many children were getting milk from his cows.
Wow.
And he was so proud of it. He said, "Look, I have now produced enough milk today for 14 more children." And it was that immediacy that was so, he was so invigorated by trying to figure out how his cows could become more productive, how they could produce more milk for children. And I went to visit a local medical clinic, and each doctor was responsible for a certain part of town. And their success was if that part of town was healthy, which was also a different way of looking at their work. And I don't think that it needs to be equated with a particular form of government to experience the significance of your work, because it actually provides for another mouth, for another healthy person, for sustenance of daily bread. And so I also want to start then that to say that work, however, in our culture is very, very ambiguous, might be the word, that there are a lot of complexities about what our work actually does and why we have to examine what's happened. Julie Poulter also is another person that I love to, who talks about work, and she says, "My grandfather died late in the afternoon on an October day. My dad was called with the news in the middle of a second shift at the candy factory. They let him leave early. He stopped at home, changed into his daytime work clothes, jeans, white t-shirt, work boots, quilted nylon jacket, then headed to my grandfather's farm a mile away to take the corn picker back to the field. It was harvest time. There was work to be done." I think that, again, is that sense of life, death and life in the very same moment. That is sort of what we experience and what puts us close to what it is that God means by work and what it is about in our lives. So the question for us is, how does our daily work provide daily bread? And yesterday I talked about Christian vocation as given, that we're all given this common vocation to increase the love of God, neighbor, self, all of creation. And that the issue is not our call, but discerning what it means in our daily work, in our particular time in history, with our particular resources, our gifts, our responsibilities, our options. So that it is critical then to examine our work, and I'm talking mostly about the United States at this point, so, and I'm talking about mostly about Protestantism, which in general is pretty middle, what we would quote call middle class in the US, and what that means for us in our context. It's not all of us, and we have to be very careful about that, but how we understand that. And I want to start off with another quote, and what I consider to be for myself my daily meditation. And it's from Robert McAfee Brown, who I don't know if you know. He died a couple years ago. He was a theologian, liberation theology. And he was a man of immense compassion and work for justice. And his work, in his books, he finally said that all our work needs to be examined by the following. Does what has been attained increase or diminish the chance for children to grow up without fear, without hunger, without human diminishment? I think if we had that before us, we would probably do well.
Could you do that again, do you mind?
No, not at all. He says, does what has been attained increase or diminish the chance for children to grow up without fear, without hunger, without human diminishment? So first, though I am a practical theologian, and what I do, and I teach in a seminary. I'm Lynn Rhodes, by the way. Did I forget to introduce myself in case you know who I am? I teach in a non-denominational seminary, but it's mostly UCC, Baptist, Methodist disciples, some Lutherans, in a consortium of 8 seminaries. So that's sort of where I'm coming from, and I've been working with people who are preparing for church ministries, for religious ministries, and I've been working with congregants a lot about their understanding of church and what it means to them and why they go to church and what they expect. And so this is coming out of that background, so you can sort of place me in my particular approach to this. But even though I do practical theology, I think history is very important to understand where we are. So I want to do just a little historical background to this, and then get into the sort of my research in congregations around the issue of daily work. And I want to say, first of all, that one of the things I said yesterday, too, was that the Industrial Revolution really was a revolution. And we are still in a revolution around work. Work, the meaning of work and how we work is changing so rapidly. And some of our assumptions about work life just don't fit the reality. There was a very famous book that came out about 10 years ago by Jeremy Rifkin on will there even be work for masses of people? Because of the kind of work that's needed, machines, technology. So our idea that a good person is a good worker may not be adequate to what the work scene is going to be in the future. But anyway, one of the things that it means is that things are changing, and we have to constantly reassess our assumptions about what work means and what's going on, both in our culture and the world. And tomorrow I want to talk about the world's work, but today I want to concentrate on the U.S. And that in the context of our country, one of the things it has meant for most people is that work has become associated with a daily wage, not with necessarily what you produce, but how much you are paid for what you produce. Those of us who get to choose to do work that is also something we care about are still a minority. Most people do jobs that they may have some interest in or they may have some skill in, but it's usually what they can get and what they need. And they see that what they're producing is not what they need, it's the wages that they get for it that gives them what they need. So that's a very different way of understanding work life. And so to understand that, to go back a little bit in our economy, our particular economy, I would say its highest value is productivity and how much it gains in terms of monetary value, the bottom line. money is the bottom line. But in this, then, in the economy, the meaning of work has had people who manage workers have had to come up against what makes people work. Now, capitalism in its most basic or naive form assumed that people are greedy and competitive, and that self-interest, that you work on people's self-interest, which was very narrowly defined, by the way, and that that would be what caused people to be good workers. And in the early 19th century, I don't know how many of you ever heard of Frederick Taylor in The Gospel of Efficiency. Any of you heard of Frederick Taylor? Well, this is
it's stuff I work on too.
So oh, okay. Well, then you can fill in where I. Well, and around 1910, he was very interested in work and looking at the Industrial Revolution and the mechanization of labor, but also of productivity. And he wanted to see how much the body could produce before breaking down. And he wanted to study how efficient could we be? How much could we produce? And he saw that as a good, not as a bad thing, but how far could you push the body before it broke? So how much could you expect of workers? And that was he was going about it scientifically. So he worked on this, and he saw the body as a machine. You know, he sort of equated it with how a machine works. And he was concerned with what were the outer limits of pressure that could be applied to an object before it broke, was how he described it. So he set out to perfect people as better machines. And assumptions about people as workers, which I think are still there in our culture. One was that the poor are ennobled by their adversity and they must be managed for their own good. Order is obtained by the enlightened elite. Faith by the enlightened pastor. I mean, think about this. That some of us know, that some of us have are more human than others in some basic sense. And that others must be relegated to repetitive tasks. Order is maintained and dedicated to scientific principles. So he did these time experiments. And he would try to take a person and he would see how fast they could do things. And he decided the most efficient model was a person doing the same thing over and over and over again. So he had people all set up down the line. And then he would put a worker in there and he would see how fast that worker could work. And then he would write down so that the company would know that all workers. And the other interesting thing is that 83, I think it was a very significant date in terms of work when the railroads established standard time. And 2 years later, for the first time, clocks appeared in factories. You don't even think about that now. But it used to be you worked until the work got done. Or as a craftsperson, you worked until, it was what it should be. But no, now it's work by time and by time units. And so early on, workers used to call the managers time thieves. Was there? Time thieves. Thieves. But then, as they worked on this, they discovered that workers could only be forced to go so far. And then they started rebelling. And they would do slowdowns. They would do sabotage. I remember reading about one worker in a car factory who said that the only way that he kept his spirit alive was that every once in a while he would just let a car go by. And that was his highlight for the day. And we know who got those cars, don't we? was, how does one, so one of the interesting things about this is that we have developed certain concepts under capitalism of what makes people work, and yet, all the time, managers are trying to figure out ways to make people work, and they're discovering that it isn't greed, is the bottom line. It isn't some of these things that have been told, that we've been told are essential, and that workers keep rebelling. So into this sort of time management and productivity, they discovered that salary even didn't help, and furthermore, that workers were organizing into unions and labor. And so then they said, well, what are we going to do about this? And again, it wasn't malicious. It was people who were coming along. I mean, Frederick Taylor was really intent on providing a better society. And the next person that kind of exemplifies the whole period is Elton May and the Human Relations Movement. And what he proposed and what he worked on scientifically to discover or to try to prove was that you had to provide people with emotional care and they would be more productive. And that if workers felt some bonding among themselves and with management, they would increase productivity. So he did all these experiments to prove that. And one of them that I just love is called the light bulb experiment, in which he isolated this group of workers for I don't know how many years and tried all his experiments on them to see what would work and what. And one of the things he did was he kept dimming the lights on this one group of workers until they could hardly see. And then he came in and said, do you need increased lighting? And they said, oh yes, that would be so helpful. So he changed the light bulbs, but he kept the light at the same level. So they really couldn't see any better, but they all produced more. They had been cared about. They had been asked, they had been respected as people. And even though, in actual fact, nothing changed, they were more productive. Again, when we think about the human being, you know, and work, what is going on here? I don't know if any of you remember The Search of Excellence by Tom Peters and Robert Waterman came out in 1983, which is not that long ago, and they're still referred to all over the place in terms of management theory. And what they wrote was, what we observed time and again, extraordinary energy exerted above and beyond the call of duty when the worker is given even a modicum of apparent control over his or her destiny. Control experiments of, oh, and then he did this, they did this experiment that I also love. They had people in a room and they had one group of people with a lot of background noise and they gave them these puzzles to solve. And they had a group in another room with all this background noise, but they had little switches that they could lower the background noise. The people in the room with the switches solved the puzzles 5 times faster. But the kicker was, none of them used the switch. It was the idea that they could control the noise, that they could control their environment. This is what fascinates me. I mean, you may not be fascinated. I find this very interesting. So today, in our work society, we have this emphasis on trying to figure out what makes workers more productive. And in the present day, what we need now is we're moving into the highly technological and innovative culture and taking our daily work and shipping it overseas with it, is people who are very creative and who have ideas. And so what management has now discovered is that these people also will only work so hard for money, and what they want is meaningful work. And this is what I talked about yesterday also about the development of spirituality in work. There are seminars all over the place with managers about how to help people feel spiritually meaning, find spiritual meaning in their work life. And the bottom line, as I said, in about 90% of these books, and I'll talk more about spirituality tomorrow, is it will make them more productive. That's the line I always look for to see what is the bottom line here when we're talking about spirituality. I'm not sure that being more productive is what it means to be spiritually built. Yes.
Do you want to say something about how productivity is understood and measured over time? I mean, it seems to me, like, for example, the shift from Taylor, who's working with factories, to the kind of work that you're talking about now. One of the difficulties is precisely Taylor could measure by his standards productivity, because it's how many widgets you make in an hour. And we can agree or disagree whether that's a good thing to measure, but you can measure it. And he could see, well, if my father actually was an efficiency expert, so you know, he said, if you're gonna staple the paper, if you put all of them in the right orientation, you can do more quicker with less stress. That's
right.
Part of the efficiency.
That's right.
The less
right.
stress.
Yeah, there are a lot of things. It's not all bad.
But the kind of work that many middle and upper class people do isn't stapling paper.
That's right.
It's
that's right.
thinking of the words on the paper. And that's a little bit harder to know what constitutes productivity.
Technological advance. I come from Silicon Valley really is so powerful in the Bay Area. And there is the people who come out with innovation, and that the stockholders, that what they produce gives back more money.
So then it also is related to cash.
Yes, absolutely. It's absolutely related to cash.
Once work gets abstracted into money, even when Taylor's talking about widgets, he's not really talking about widgets, he's talking about more widgets to sell so that the company gets more money.
Right.
And that's Roseanne's question before about household labor that doesn't produce money.
That's right, exactly. No, the economy is based on money, and it's that's the bottom line. And that's one of the issues that we really need to look at. And one of the things that I feel the church is really called to, which again I want to talk about a little bit more later on, but what I call theo-economic imagination. I think we're at a time when the church has got to see as one of its major tasks imagining what our economic life can and should be about, and what values we hold as workers. And how would we begin to work toward that vision? Which doesn't mean it isn't ambiguous and it isn't complex and it isn't, but the idea that there is no alternative is no longer acceptable.
We were talking about that in our adult Sunday school class a few weeks ago, and there was great resistance. I said, you know, I really struggle with the fact that on our budget, I have growing boys, and I go to Kmart, and it kills me, because I know who made those kind of shirts. So my alternative is what? And one of the women made me feel better by saying, well, even if you were buying, you know, more expensive shoes, they're still made by the same child labor. So it doesn't matter how much money you spend. I said, but I am, you know, benignly, nonetheless, contributing to an economy, to a world system that's unjust, and I don't know what to do about it. And one of my friends said, I can't even think about it. I won't even think about it. It makes me feel too guilty. I can't do that. I have too many other things to worry about.
And that's,
I don't know what, you know, should my children go barefoot? I mean, do you... What is the just?
Well, one thing your children could learn is they don't need a new pair of tennis shoes every time the style changes.
It's not a style thing, it's a size thing.
When you buy a Kmart, you don't find style.
Well, the bottom line for me in terms of church, and what I want to get to a little bit here is some of the church examples of how churches are working on this, but the bottom line is for me is that we talk about this. Mm-hmm. That money and our work lives become central to our church life. That otherwise we're lying when we say God is love. We don't believe it. And I want to talk about how people have interpreted that when they about church in a little bit here. So let me see in terms of time. I always keep talking too much. But that today in our society, we're also faced with one of the interesting things. When I went to seminary in the 60s, one of the questions, one of the classes we had was, what are we going to do with all the leisure time that our congregants are going to have? Do you remember that, any of you from the 50s, when we assumed that work life was going to take up much less of our time? But instead, what we were producing in the 1950s, if we were producing that same amount individually, we would only have to be working half time. Nice thought, isn't it? Once every other year, take off. Or just work half the week instead of the full week. But instead, our actual work hours have increased for those of us who work. And so this is, so on the one hand, we have this ability to produce so much. And at the, on the other hand, we're working harder and more stressful, more burnout for those who are workers than we did have. And so again, to look at why are we doing this? What is this all about? And what control or lack of control do we have over this kind of reality? So that we do have higher standards of living, we do have innovations that have saved lives. We're not trying to denigrate what has been good, but to look at what is happening in terms of this work, that we have increasing numbers of working poor, people who work three or four jobs and can't make enough to feed their family adequately in the United States, not overseas, here. And then we have some of us who are so stressed out. More women and men are working so that families, in terms of children, neither the man or the woman is home that much. And one of the studies that Juliet Shore has done on women and work has been that because of the stress level, women are finding their emotional life in their workplace and not in their children or their home. And the reason is that because of the stress, when they get home, it is getting things done and feeding the kid and getting to the bed and getting their homework done and getting them off to here and feeling so stressed at home that they don't have time. And at work, they can talk about things or they can have, you know, they can, they're doing things that are in some ways expressive of themselves. And so this is a very interesting phenomenon. We talk about family values. And that if women and men are finding emotional life, I mean, she did a study on women, but I wouldn't be surprised if both, I find more emotional satisfaction in the populace, in their work lives, because it is so stressful to try and combine both. But especially for women who still do the majority of the homework as well as working outside the home.
Is that why you see an increase of workplace affairs?
That might very well be. That might very well be. Who understands me? I can tell you, when I first started in campus ministry as a single woman, the number of male pastors that hit on me because I understood them and their work life and their wives didn't. So from my own experience, yeah. It was quite amazing to me. So the first thing I always used to do was get to know the wife, because I was the only woman in campus ministry at that time. Mm-hmm. That was in the 60s, and there weren't many of us.
Do you think any of that falls into, because I've been at-home mom and not at-home mom, sort of. I've always been a part-time not at-home mom. But do you think some of that comes, though, because when you walk in that door at home, it's real world and real you and real stuff, and you can sort of mask all that in the workplace. You can be that who you want to be. You can sort, you know what I mean? You don't have your baggage with you. I mean, I don't know, but I mean, I'm just curious because I sometimes laugh even with my husband's co-workers and when they meet me and just comments they say in that. And I think he is two people. He is the person he is at work.
And then he's the person he is at home.
And then he is that vulnerable other guy, you know, with all of his quirks and wonderful things when he's with me. You know what I'm saying?
Yeah.
And,
yeah.
And I think he has to be that in the role he has at work. But I mean, I think...
Well, that's also was one of the understandings of family in industrial revolution was the wife was supposed to provide the humanizing element for the husband who worked in the work world.
One of the things I'm interested in, and I haven't seen anybody talk about it, is we say a lot about how the industrial revolution separated the home and the workplace, right? That if you're in an agricultural society, home and work, they're all mixed together. And that when once you have factories and offices, there's the workplace and home. But as we restructure work for so many people, now we're losing that boundary again, and people find that very disconcerting.
Mm-hmm.
And I haven't heard people talk about that at all, the way in which these, except among my friends. You know, we talk about working on a campus, bringing our kids to the campus,
yeah.
But also bringing work home.
Yeah.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah.
How that's
how that is. Yeah.
There's
it's one of the issues.
There's some stuff. The Work Family Institute.
Yeah.
Out of Washington D.C. or Chicago has been writing stuff on work family balance, and the whole issue of technology has only allowed us to bring work home.
Right now, email.
Like,
I hate email.
Whatever
I can't
people
help
who
right.
use their
follows me.
Drive instead of
yeah.
to decompress. They're doing those last minute voicemails.
Right.
They get home,
mm-hmm.
deal with the kids, then they do the email. So the Work Family Institute.
Mm-hmm. Work Family Institute.
Yeah, it's, I have a friend who works with them and has done a lot of that. So.
Yeah.
I want to just go on a little bit about getting to congregations. When I went around and interviewed people in congregations, and I asked them three questions. I asked them how worship related to their work life, where they experienced God in their work life, and what they desired for their children's work life. Three questions I asked them. And I went to very different kinds of congregations. And there are four groups that sort of emerged in this with their understanding of church and worship and their work lives. The one who were workers who got paid by the hour and didn't have much control over their work lives, they experienced church as sanctuary and worship as getting away. They said, no, church doesn't have much to say about my work life. It doesn't really help me there. But church provides sanctuary away from it. And it provides me even with ways to do things that, give me chances to do things that are meaningful to me. But it's mostly sanctuary. So what the church says about vocation doesn't really apply to me. That was fun. The second group I went to, people I interviewed were business people who were managers and directors and CEOs and people who had supposedly a lot of control and who chose the kind of work that they were doing. They were highly trained and very, very aware of things. And I asked them also what worship meant in terms of their work life. And they said the same thing, sanctuary. It was the place to get away from work. One woman said, I go to choir and it is the only time I do not have my cell phone with me. And I asked them where they found God in work. The workers, working class people would sometimes talk about other people. The business people, it was really interesting when I asked a question in one of the groups, it was dead silence. I said, where is God? You don't bring God to work. God's already there. That's what we say theologically. God's there. How is God revealed to you in your work life? They all went around. I mean, they were really people who were doing creative things, and they said, I met the devil. Let me tell you about the devil. I've learned a lot about the devil. Very interesting. They saw themselves as people trying to be ethical, good, living out their Christian faith, but in a world in which that was not the bottom line. And if they didn't watch out, they'd get stabbed in the back. Mm-hmm. And that's the way I described it.
And that was the creative class?
that was the business people who were working in business. And they said, the pastor's sermons are idealistic and have nothing to do with the hard realities of my work life and the decisions I have to make. They don't understand my context at all. Or the ambiguities of it. Do I fire these 40 people? Do I move my company overseas? Do I, you know, in order to compete, the decisions I have to make each day, they talk about it in these sort of spiritualized terms. And they don't give me any help for my real daily life decisions. Now, the third group were the professionals who were in service jobs, teachers, lawyers, social workers, people like that. And they said, oh, yes, worship relates to my daily life. Interesting. Those of us in the helping profession in clergy can speak to others in other helping professions. Mm-hmm. And the work make and work issues are really actually informed and shaped by worship. So context is really, really important for what is going on here. And then the non-paid workers and retired, and more of our churches are mostly, are largely retired, at least churches, I mean not largely, but there's a large, significant bunch of us, and I'm moving into that area very quickly, that we are either expected to do church work and recruited to do the work of the church because we're, quote, not out there doing paid work.
Real work.
Real work. As mothers, as housekeepers, as people who care for their parents, as people who do all the kinds of unpaid labor. That really is the essential work. That on one level, they said, they experienced, you know, the church says it values them, but in its practices, they don't feel like they're doing significant work. It's not really seen as the basic work of church. Instead, because they aren't, quote, getting a salary, they are recruited as the volunteers who should be keeping the church going.
Yeah, there's nothing worse than, well, you've got time.
Yes, and so this is the kind of, and then retired, what we now have, you know, we're heading into an area for those of us who have retirement and can retire, we have incredible productive years and ways in which we could begin to rethink our lives, but not necessarily encompassed within the church. Again, the one of the things that gets me is it's not that there isn't work that needs to be done. There is so much good work that needs to be done, but it is not paid or valued. And so, you know, maybe there are ways in which we need to think about creating ways to get good work done that also provides living for people. And maybe some of us who have some time and energy can begin to think about some of those creative ways to provide alternatives, not only for ourselves, but for others. So this is what I learned from talking with people about their work lives. So the question then is how, you know, for us, for those of us who are pastors or congregants, the other amazing thing is I went to one church that was known as the most socially activist church in our area. And Berkeley, that's a pretty activist church in the Bay Area. And they had been known for social activism for 20, 30 years. They had a pastor who was involved in the civil rights movement, a pastor who was workers, justice, all kinds of things. And I went to talk with them, and they said, oh, we don't talk about our work lives here. I said, said, you don't talk about your work lives. And they said, no, our pastor told us not to talk about our work lives because that divides us. Because we don't know if you're a janitor and I'm a physician, and therefore we relate to each other as human beings. And I thought, that's interesting, that I can't tell you that my three children are more beautiful than yours. Because that would divide us. I can't tell you about my kids. That might make you feel bad. I don't have children, but as a hypothetical thing, I have nieces and nephews who...
So how did it work there?
The pastor had retired at that point. He'd retired the year before, and one of the people in the congregation asked me to come and talk with people about their work lives. But what was so interesting is that first evening, I just asked him to go around and tell what they did, you know, how they understand themselves as workers. None of them knew anything about each other, and they had been together as a community for people who were in the room 10 to 20 years. And they did not know what each other did.
How obedient.
But isn't that a good thing?
I know, though. We've been coming to Holden for years. And I can say I've been here for a week sometimes, and maybe 5 years seeing somebody, and cannot tell you what they do. Mm-hmm. Because that's not something that immediately comes up.
Yeah. Well, what I want to say is that I think that's a conversation, not because of identity in the way that we said it, you know, what do you do? Ah, you're a lawyer, how great. But how do we understand our work? Because we spend more time in work, whether it's paid or unpaid, than anything else we do.
Yeah, but I think culturally we're programmed. And I mean, I like the concept, but I think the application of it, you know, doesn't apply. I mean, we at Holden, I mean, I even noticed you here, when you sit at a table, you know, where are you from is the first question. And then what do? You know, and the minute the pastor and the couple is identified, the other person is out of the conversation. It just happens.
That's right.
It just happens.
It does happen.
It's not a bad thing unless you're not the pastor in the relationship. You go find other spouses to say, so what do you get out of that? It's just what we're culturally oriented to do.
Yeah. And my thing is that the church is the place to counter that culture.
But how?
To counter it.
It's so
beginning, I know, but beginning to talk. And let me tell you about some churches that have done this.
I've got
shoes issues,
I've got spouse issues.
Let me see
if I can. I'm on the boat. I'm out of here.
I want
to
say right now,
Carol?
I am not going to be able to give you answers.
Buy the CD.
I hope you ask everybody that question. Because my understanding is what I'm trying to work on, as I've been working on these issues around work, is that it's both we are, as individuals, don't have excessive control over a lot of these things. As your friend said, I don't even want to think about it, it just makes me guilty. And I want us to honor the complexities of our work lives, of our individual work lives, and what are the issues and the concerns that each person has. My fears are real fears about my health care. I'm a single woman. What am I going to do in my old age? Who's going to take care of me? It's not an illegitimate fear about money and security. And those are questions that I think we should really honor and talk about. One question in the church that I asked in the church I was in was, how much money does everybody make? I just wanted to see what happened.
Well, you figured 10%, looked at their budget.
And one of the things I loved about the fact that my parents were school teachers was that their salaries were public knowledge. And I didn't realize how that influenced me, that money was something you could talk about. And you could say what you earned and what you did with it and why and whether you know, what were your issues around it. What would be more important in our church than to talk about how we work with our money, what it means to us, but we don't do it because of this fear that it reveals. And yet we're talking about faith. It reveals who we are, you know. We've got to talk about those issues. I'm not saying I know what the solutions are. I am saying that I do believe we have to talk about them. And the four, let me, yes, I don't want to.
I just want to say that there's an organization called Ministry of Money that does exactly that.
And I have their little email here.
We've been to one of their retreats and or workshop, weekend workshops, and it's just an amazing discussion because you're all there to talk about your relationship with money and you talk about, you know, what is your salary? Everybody's puts in, writes on a piece of paper what their salary is and their situation, and you get, at the end of the weekend, you get a list of everybody, then you have a sense of, you know, how the organization is. And it's a very powerful thing to discuss.
Well, it is. I want to say it is. But we put up a lot of, I think in the religious world, we put up this thing about we are sacrificial and then we have to come up with the concrete data on this. All of us are trying to, who's more sacrificial than somebody else? Or I lived collectively for a while and we put all of our money together and we had this one little category. So we had to come up with our budget every year about what we were spending our money on. And we always had this one little budget item that said, I don't have to tell you how I'm going to do this.
So that would be the chocolate latte.
Yeah.
Where occasionally you can't go with that for another day.
Yeah. There are four different church types. I don't know if you, I can go with this. I don't know where this, how to go with this, but that I have worked with over time that have had different responses to this issue. One is a church, a very small little church in New Hampshire, and the pastor had worked in big churches. He'd been part of the civil rights movement and worked with community outreach in Chicago with Martin Luther King Jr., and he'd seen his friends of his killed, all of this, and he had six children, and he came to the end of his rope, sort of burnout, and he went to New Hampshire and took this little church with about 20 members, maybe one of them under 70, more like 13 members or something like that. And he decided that the most important thing the church could do as a church community was meaningful work. And they would do nothing that wasn't meaningful to people, including worship. They would do nothing unless it was meaningful. But what he set out to do was to provide them with ways to see other people in meaningful work that was meaningful to them. So he just gave them all these options. And so the church, one of the first things he did was take three women who were in their 80s from New Hampshire. They got interested in El Salvador. And they decided to take some things to El Salvador in the 70s to a little church down there that didn't have anything. So they loaded up this bus, and these three women they were 75, and he got in this bus, and they drove to El Salvador. And they met this little Catholic church, and they discovered liberation theology. These women came back to New Hampshire, to Franconia, New Hampshire, a small little town, and they were so fired up, they went to the Catholic church, and they said, we didn't know you guys were so terrific. And they looked around, they said, what do we need here? We have people who can't keep themselves warm in the winter. These women started a wood collective where people could collect after the people had been in lumber people, and they collected wood. The church started a crafts collective. They started an oral history project in the retirement in the long-term care facility. Because his thing was that every person had meaningful work, and the person dying still had meaningful work, and it was the story of their life. Mm-hmm. And so he had kids go in and write down their stories, and so they developed a printing press to print stories to say, you know, your life of wisdom is needed by our community, even as you are dying. And so he created, and this church just blossomed with people doing all kinds of things that were meaningful for them. But they didn't do anything unless five people were dying to do it. That was his other criteria. So he would throw out, he'd say, oh, I had so many great ideas, And I took them places to see people who were doing great, and it just didn't work. But they would read their Bible, and they would think about, you know, should we start a goat farm? And if five people began to feel excited about it, then they would go ahead. So that was one kind of church that was organized. And his bottom line was he was the coach for meaningful work. That was his definition of himself as a pastor. And that, when I went up to talk with them about their work, that was how we understood. You know how they understood him? Our pastor loves us. He just sits around and talks with us all the time. That's what he does. He just has a pot of coffee on, and we come by and he chats. And he would say, tell him about the projects, tell him about what you're doing. They're saying, our pastor loves us. So it's very interesting. His involvement in helping them find meaningful work, they saw as really listening and caring about them. And it was amazing what kind of profound things that had. The second church is one you probably know about, the Church of Savior in Washington, D.C. Now that's a model of church, which is high commitment, very high commitment, and small groups of high commitment. But what I have watched and observed over time is they have taken people who said, what do I do about my shoes, buying my shoes? What do I do about the daily life? And as small groups, they have actually sort of revolutionized their own sense of what was possible and done some amazing things in these groups, have created work. There's a group that, you know, that prays every morning who's in Congress. And their work is inspired by together saying, what does it mean to follow Jesus today in Congress? And talking with each other about what it means, because they know what are the issues they're facing. So that's another kind of model, but it's high commitment and high, they have to spend 2 years in theological study before they can even, you know, it's a high commitment. So that's one kind of model. It's not what everybody should do. There's a church in East Boston that I work with, which is low income and workers. And the pastor there had understood her job as advocate for workers. So that church really focused around advocacy for decent wages, for unionizing, for the city, you know, good health care benefits. That church, that's what that church did. Because that was what the context of the people's lives, their work was, did not have dignity and did not have enough to keep them going. The fourth one is the one in Silicon Valley, Palo Alto. Highly educated young professionals in the technology field. And they were feeling overwhelmed and overstressed. Their jobs were giving them no time for their children. Or home life, or relationships, or et cetera. Their bills, their monthly bills were astronomical in terms of housing, some of you know. Just to keep going, they had to produce more and more, get more salary, move up the ladder. And so we began talking about their work lives. And they began to experiment with things like co-housing. And getting together in small groups to provide common child care. And beginning to think about ways to lower their monthly expense level so that they could do the work they really wanted to do. And how could they do that? The only way they could do it, though, was collectively. One group I know in a church bought a whole apartment building as a church group. And each family had their own apartment. And they had a big grassy area out in back for the kids, and they had, you know, different, some people who retired would watch the kids during certain times. Common places where they could meet, but they had their own apartments. But by doing that together, they really lowered their monthly expenses, and they began to have more options. So individually, there are things we need to do. Collectively, we need to act, as I think, as a church, in terms of economic imagination, what I call theo-economic imagination. We need to provide vision that helps us move toward what we really care about. I'm over time.
You're talking.
So the spouse got the shoes card.
You did. Doesn't matter what he does. I want to tell you what I do. We begin to speak up for ourselves.
Well, I have no problem with that.
I also have some copies of the poem to be of use and some other things that right there, three different files. Thank you. I'll see you.